Hello everybody and welcome to tonight's Emerging Minds and MHPM webinar series on infant and child mental health. I'd like to bid a warm greetings to the more than 500 of you who have joined us tonight, and also welcome all the viewers who are watching this on podcast. So tonight's webinar 3 in a 6-series webinar that MHPN and Emerging Minds are presenting this year, and it's on engaging parents of school-aged children, which is very topical for many of us. So before we begin, Emerging Minds and MHPN would like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land across Australia upon which our webinar presenters and participants are located. We wish to pay the respect to elders past, present and future, for the memories, the traditions, the culture and hopes of Indigenous Australians. So welcome. As I said, my name's Dan Moss. I'm the Workforce Development Manager here at Emerging Minds, and tonight is the third in our series of webinars on infant and child mental health. Just keep our eye out for our future webinars. In particular, on the 7th of November, we have an exciting webinar about engaging parents with children approaching adolescence, which will be facilitated by Dr. Michael Carr-Gregg and Ellie Robinson. In early 2019, we will also be presenting a webinar on supporting children's mental health after trauma, and one on engaging with children and parents with complex needs, and in particular, thinking about a systems approach. So, introducing tonight's panel, we have Nicola Palfrey, who is a psychologist and who also works through the Australian National University providing trauma assistance and advice with Emerging Minds. Sarah Seacamp, who's going to give an occupational therapist view. Mandy Walsh, who is our child and family partner and lived experience consumer at Emerging Minds. First of all, Nicola, I'd like to welcome you and thank you for participating tonight. Nicola, I know that you've worked quite a bit in your role as a psychologist with schools in ways that help school-aged children. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, thanks, Dan, and welcome everybody. Thanks for having us along again. So yeah, in my role as a clinical psychologist, I've both worked individually with families and helping them to engage with their children when they're having difficulties, but also working in with the school systems, running a trauma sensitive schools program. So helping to skill up whole of schools, the educators and administration and so forth to help meet the needs of kids that may have emerging mental health issues.
Great. Thank you, Nicola. I'd like also to introduce Sarah Seacan, who tonight is going to provide a view from OTs. Sarah, I understand a lot of the work that you have done in the past has been situated around play, both with parents and children. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. Thanks, Dan. I think, you know, as an occupational therapist, we're particularly interested in play because it's that primary occupation of children. It's how they do so much of their growing and learning, their social emotional growth, their physical and their cognitive growth. And so I think, you know, it's really nice to work within the child's strengths, which play is often a strength for them if we're using child-led play. And so I've really enjoyed working with children in a play setting and then working alongside their parents about building their capacity to see how they can, I guess, play in helpful ways with their children to support their children's growth and development.
Thanks, Sarah. That's great. Our next presenter tonight is Mandy Walsh. Mandy contributes in many different ways to the National Workforce Centre here at Emerging Minds as a child and family partner. Mandy, I'm wondering if you could just tell us a little bit about that role at Emerging Minds.
Yes, sure, Dan, and thank you for having me, and I appreciate the opportunity. I have worked with Emerging Minds in the role of providing lived experience. So I suffered from postnatal psychosis in 2010 and went on to have health difficulties after that. And I am able to use this, which actually feels quite liberating, to use these experiences to inform on various
things. Thanks, Mandy. We really appreciate your contribution tonight and look forward to your presentation. Okay, so a little bit about tonight before we kick off with our wonderful presenters. I won't go through the ground rules because we've already done that through your registration. But just to let you know, if you do need any technical support, the FAQ tab at the top of the screen can be accessed, as well as the Redback Help Desk on 1-800-291-863. If any significant issues should arise, an announcement will be made to everyone. So, the learning outcomes for tonight. For an exploration of child-inclusive practice tonight, we want to focus on children's social and emotional well-being. And our three presenters will be focusing on identification of strategies that facilitate positive child-focused conversations with parents and children that uncovers their relationship strengths and vulnerabilities. They'll describe practitioner tools that help parents to focus on the developmental needs of their children when facing adversity, conflict or separation. They'll invite practitioners to recognise the importance of regular shared playtime between children and their parents. So we look forward to that. Just a note on the webinar platform. So as you know, the chat box is there tonight for a general chat amongst human services providers. And we really encourage you to use that as we go through tonight. We'll really endeavour wherever possible to answer your questions and to put those questions to our three presenters. Also, just a note that you will be asked at tonight's conclusion to provide feedback. This provision of feedback throughout our first two webinars was a really wonderful aspect of what we did and is really allowing us to constantly change and get better at what we do. So we appreciate your time and effort in filling that out. But now I'm going to pass over to Nicola Palfrey, who's going to talk a little bit about the case study that you will have all seen in Charlie and thinking about some of the issues that Charlie's having at home, both with his dad, some of the worries that his mother Kate might be having, and how Nicola might be working with the family through a child-focused lens. So Nicola, welcome.
Thank you, Dan. So when I was looking at this case study of Charlie, I suppose it struck with me, I've had a number of referrals similar to this over the years of working with children and young people. And I suppose I thought I'd start with what we might receive as a referral for someone, for Charlie's family. And often you may get a referral that talks about Charlie in terms of behavioural issues, anger management, some of the aggression and violence that you saw in the video that he directed towards his mum in certain scenes, the note that he's disengaged from school, and general non-compliance, those sorts of terms that you would often get in a referral in a clinical setting, whether it be within private practice or in another setting. And when I get those referrals, I suppose when I hear about these, my angry boys, as I like to, well, I think of them, when I hear angry boys, I often think about sad boys. And the reason for that is often when I work with children such as Charlie, often do exercises around anger and exercise around anger being a secondary issue. And what we mean by that is there's always a feeling before anger. And time after time when I talk to boys such as Charlie about, tell me about the last time you were angry, and we work through what they were feeling before it, it always strikes me how often they say that they're sad. And that we know in society broadly, girls as well, but we often don't encourage kids to show sadness. We get told to toughen up or to get over it and so forth. And so anger is somehow a more acceptable emotion. That's what we can see in boys like Charlie. They can be scapegoated, so their behaviour is a thing to be fixed. And they often come to therapy and parents can often say to me, I need you to help fix my child. And Charlie, I imagine, would present in that therapy setting as shut down and unlikely to want to engage in therapy, and I wouldn't blame him. And so really, I suppose, when I look at referrals such as this, I really want to start to understand Charlie in his context. And what I mean by that is, how he's travelling overall, what's going on at home, how's he going at school, what is he interested in? We've got some information in the referral about what his dad's interested in, and I'd like to know a little bit more about Charlie and want to get to know him a little bit and understand a bit more about him from a whole child point of view, I suppose. In terms of where to start, I think if I was working with this family, it's really important to set the context from the beginning, set the expectations for the family so they know how you're going to approach it and what your philosophy is in working with these issues. And that would be established by the expectation that the first session or first few sessions perhaps, or even all of the sessions, would actually be with the adults in Charlie's life, in this case his parents. The expectation would be that we'll be with both parents. You make a really big effort to engage both mum and dad, and that can take some flexibility around timing and juggling, but say that that's a really big priority because Charlie really needs his parents to support him through this time that he's having, and that it is a family process. It's not just Charlie's problem that we're dealing with, but we're really looking to support Charlie. And that can be tricky sometimes. Parents are often confused as to why they're being brought into session. And that is often because their expectation is that they'll be judged and judged harshly about their parenting. And so an approach that I can find helpful is listen to adults or children or anybody in therapy actually until they can. And what we mean by that is people really need to feel like you're alongside this journey with them rather than just coming in over the top and going to direct them as to what they're doing wrong and how to fix it. We all talk about unconditional positive regard, and I think that's extremely important. Everybody wants to be the best parent they can. No one intentionally sets out to harm their children or to do a bad job at parenting. And so naming that with parents and saying that that's what we're going to work together to do. And I think working with parents or asking parents about what their fears are for Charlie, so for Kate and for his dad, like what are they worried about? What concerns do they have about Charlie and what's brought them along to seek your help? And then instilling hope and saying this is manageable, it's fantastic that we're seeing this now and we're not waiting till things escalate. Together apart together, what I mean by that is a way of working with the family that allows everybody to have their share of their airspace and to bring it all back together. So together in terms of chatting to the parents together, chatting to Charlie and his mum, chat to Charlie and his dad, but also having some individual time with each member of the family. And particularly with children, that's important over time as you start to build a relationship with Charlie and you get to know him a little bit more. He'll often share with you things that he wouldn't do otherwise when mum and dad are initially in the room because they might be worried about the response of hurting their feelings or upsetting them. But then bringing the family back together through the process of therapy is really important because you're the therapist. You're not living with them 24/7. You might have one session a week of 40 or 50 minutes. That's not going to make any difference unless you can help the family to feel like they've got some more skills in their bag to actually take home and try out. So positioning yourself as a facilitator but not the all-knowing person who's going to, you know, tell them what to do every time in session. In terms of goals of therapy and how we kind of keep things on track, I think you have to keep in mind what your outcomes, what you're hoping for. And you have different goals, I suppose, for therapy for each of these members of the family. You're hoping to build Kate up, to increase her sense of competence, look at what she's doing well and how can we continue to do that, how she's managing Charlie's behaviour when it's challenging at times. We see her apologising in the clip and really building on the strengths that she has so she starts to feel like she does have the skills and the strategies and the relationship with her son to help them all through that. For Dad, we want to understand what he's going through and how he's going with being a dad and try and help him to see how his behaviour could be seen as frightening by his son or his wife and what we can do to help him manage that. Because ultimately we need Charlie's needs to be seen. His behaviour is communicating that he's not okay, whether it's his dad about his dog or he's scared because he hears his parents fighting. And we need to bring those needs to the forefront and allow them to be met. And people really, to shift anything, they need to feel like you're on their side. And I really think as a psychologist, you're often a translator. So communication can break down in families when we're stressed and worried. And so trying to, when we have those individual conversations, help work out how we can bring the family back together and have those communication skills. And the confidence, one of the things you notice, even at this age, parents can forget how to connect with their kids. They think they're not really interested in it or they knew how to do it when they were little. So working with them to tap back into those skills they had, to be together, to enjoy time together, and encourage them to get back to that. So, yeah, I think it's keeping the family in mind, trying to keep them together and help facilitate communication and build up their skills is where I would start with this family.
Thank you so much, Nicola. That's a really wonderful applied presentation. So thank you for that. Our next presenter tonight is Sarah Speakan, and Sarah's going to give us the occupational therapist perspective on Charlie and his family. So over to you, Sarah.
Thanks, Dan, and thanks, Nicola, for your wonderful presentation also. Okay, so I'm going to talk about a particular strategy or tool that you might be able to use as part of your work with Charlie and his family. So as Nicola said, often when someone like Charlie comes to us, it's because people have raised a concern about his behaviour. And so part of our role is often around lifting up what some of those triggers and stresses might be that sit underneath that behaviour and what his feelings and emotions might be. But we can also draw attention to what the strengths and protective factors might be that exist within Charlie and his family, and we can do some work around strengthening what already might be there. Okay. Play is the perfect opportunity for parents to engage with their children. When parents engage with children in play, they have this wonderful moment where they can see the world through the child's eyes. They can look at what they're interested in, how they deal with challenges, how they problem solve. And we know that when children are playing with their parents, it actually also opens up opportunities for communication. Children are a lot more comfortable communicating while playing, while doing, rather than just sitting and talking. And when children experience their parents' full attention in play, this is a really special feeling for them, and it really contributes to their feelings of self-worth and strengthens this connection and this protective relationship that they have with their parents. And it's really nice, as Nicola alluded to, when families are having to do lots of hard work through times when they're facing adversities, if we can find even some small ongoing moments of shared joy, then we know that those families and those children are going to have just that little bit more emotional energy to do some of the hard work they might be having to face. So then one of the challenges we know is that finding the time and energy amongst families like Charlie's, it looks like particularly Kate and Charlie are just struggling alongside each other at the minute, but having a great challenge in, finding time to be together. And so what we really want to do is do some problem solving with the family. We want to acknowledge that it is hard, that they're under pressure, and finding more time and more energy is going to be a challenge. But we also want to, join with them and help them recognise that they can start small with small moments and small opportunities. Maybe 5 minutes before bed, or maybe a half an hour on a weekend, can be an okay place to start for families that perhaps aren't spending any shared play time together at the moment. Then the other challenge when we're working with families is, sometimes families don't have the skills, as Nicola alluded to know how to play together. And so we have to provide that scaffolding, build that capacity within the family to have successful shared experiences of play. And this is a key moment for us to lift up Charlie's voice and to talk with Charlie and hear from him, what would he like play with Mum and Dad to look like? What would he have enjoyed in the past, and what would he like to bring forward from those previously enjoyed times? What perhaps didn't go so well in the past that we might want to plan to avoid and problem solve around as we're mapping out what some of this shared playtime might look like? And then for some families, I think we need to start perhaps at the very beginning if they're really in a difficult place, and just encouraging the parents to notice their child at times when it's not for those negative reasons of a dealing with problem behaviour, but it's just noticing them when they might be quietly doing something on their own, and looking at the child and asking the question, what is my child doing? I wonder what they're thinking. What are they feeling? What are they needing? And encouraging the parent to try and see the world through their child's eyes, and doing this in a relaxed tension-free time can be a wonderful way to practice this perspective taking that can be really helpful when things aren't going so well. And again, we might be asking parents to, you know, consider what's going on under the iceberg when their child might be really acting out. So in closing, sorry, the slides are jumping around a little bit. The important things I think that we can work with families on is helping parents remember that they are the most important thing to their child, and the benefits of a strong child-parent relationship are significant. We know that kids that have an ongoing supportive relationship with an adult have better mental health, they cope better with stress, they do better at school. So investing in those relationships is a really important strategy to consider. And we can also then help families recognise that play is a relatively accessible strategy that we can use to strengthen that relationship and invest in the parent and the child's emotional cup as they address some really tricky issues and times. And then finally, just I guess guiding parents to recognise that child-led play is likely to provide the outcomes that we're hoping to see, rather than perhaps as we see Chris trying to connect with Charlie but following his interest in football rather than stopping to think about what Charlie's passion might be and how he can perhaps connect with Charlie. Thank you.
Thanks, Sarah. That was a fantastic presentation, and finding those small shared moments is something that I'll certainly take out of that presentation. So thank you. Our next presenter tonight is Mandy, who is going to talk through her child and family partner lens. So over to you, Mandy.
Thanks, Dan. So just looking at the story that we've all watched and just looking firstly at Charlie's mum. So the first I could see empathise with a lot of that was going on. So mum is carrying or was carrying a huge load. It seemed that she was trying to survive in a relationship that entailed verbal abuse and possibly domestic violence, which she was probably frightened if this was happening to disclose to others or embarrassed to disclose to others. She had a career, she was working, she was parenting, she was being a wife. She also had some judgmental and unhelpful community support, the neighbour, who might have been trying her best but wasn't helpful in the situation. She's also carrying a lot of guilt. I'm not good enough, and I can also empathise with that. I'm not doing good enough. I want perfection, but I'm not getting it. I'm trying to be as good as I can, but why can't I be the best mum or dad? Just looking now at Charlie's dad, he came across as being a very authoritarian personality, living his love of football through Charlie. He didn't respect the school rules of Charlie's school. When Charlie tried to tell him what the school expected, he didn't take any notice of that. He was overbearing and forceful. And then I sort of thought beyond it, and I thought about Dad. Do we think about Dad? We seem to be thinking about Mum, but Dad may be carrying more than he can deal with. And I just wanted to point out that it's important to know we expect a lot from dads. That they can be vulnerable too, and maybe that's something as a society we need to be aware of. We're becoming better at recognising depression and anxiety in mothers, and maybe we need to gain a better understanding of that depression and anxiety can happen to fathers as well. And I think that that's important to note. So Charlie came across as a timid boy. He was grieving for his dog and no one was addressing this. He was frightened of his father, so this came across when he jumped anxiously when his father called out for him. He wanted to follow the school rules and do what his teacher said, but his father was not supportive of this. He's trying to survive as best as he knows how and is reacting to the situation with anger. It was put forward that maybe Charlie was a child of verbal and or domestic violence. A child of domestic violence has a hard road to travel. You often feel unsafe at home. You're unsure and worried when the next argument might be. home can be an unpredictable place, and you can find school is a safe place to be, a safe setting to be in. I'm speaking from lived experience. The family could benefit from family counselling. Especially important would be if counselling if there was unsafe behaviours happening at home. And Charlie could benefit. Also, there was some loss and grief happening around the dog. So some talk there and support around losing a good friend, losing a pet. Charlie's mum needs support regarding the abuse she's experiencing in the relationship. I often think parents ask, in my role as teacher sometimes, how can we talk about things? And I love a good picture book. So picture books can be a really good thing to talk through something and bring up certain topics and discuss them. Need to be honest with the people around them. So, and I'm guessing I'm not in the situation of being in domestic violence, but I'm guessing as an outsider looking in that it would be quite difficult to know who you confide in. I do know that there are people have told me that situations where you think your children may be taken away from you, or there might be something around that happening if you disclose what's going on at home. So some honest talk that, you know, everything will stay safe, you will be okay, and letting people know, possibly being encouraged to possibly let the school know, medical or medical professionals, etc. I often find that when you are in a situation of adversity, I just know in my own time of postnatal psychosis, mental illness, and being a parent that experienced that, it's often helpful to hear that you're not alone. It normalises it, so that, you know, it's common. So many people, and it did make a difference, health professionals telling me mental illness is common, and you think, oh, you know, I'm glad you say that. That does make me feel better. Just knowing that you're not alone, you're not some one standout person who's experiencing this, is quite settling. The family struggles could be mentioned to Charlie's teacher and school counsellor. I'm coming to realise in my own work setting just how valuable the school counsellor is. Children's difficulties at home can onflow onto academic difficulties. Schools can help with family difficulties, and it is a safe place to talk about family violence also. Families could be or need to be encouraged to talk to the teacher, to the principal, etc., about struggles at home, and we all have them, just in different forms. This sort of communication is useful, and it can explain behaviours of a child or of children, any sort of behaviours that are difficult or you're unsure about. Unfortunately, school counsellors are spread rather thinly in many schools, but they are very helpful people, and I do remind the school counsellor in the school I work in that she's a very important person there. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mandy. That was really useful advice there, and I think will generate and is generating lots of conversations from the chat room. So, speaking of the chat room, we will now endeavour to answer some of your questions from our panellists. So lots of questions really regarding Charlie's dad. So questions around what might it be like to work with Charlie's dad? Should he come to a session, a counselling or a psychology session, where he might be reluctant or service resistant? Nicola, I'm wondering from your experience as a psychologist whether you could talk about some of the strategies you might use with Charlie's dad.
Yeah, excuse me. Yeah, sure, Dan. I think it's important to remember that in working with Charlie's dad that we only have a small amount of information, and often when we get referrals or one point of view. So maybe you've chatted to mum, we don't actually know his story. And so I think it's really important to say that from the outset, if you're talking with dad, that you're really interested in hearing his point of view. And as I mentioned, he may be resistant. He may be defensive, or even, you know, may come across a bit intimidating to start off with. And I think holding in mind that we all have defences and we all feel like that at times, if we think people are judging us for how we are. And so I always endeavour to try and speak about the family more broadly and what his hopes are, what's going well, are there things he's particularly struggling with. As Mandy said, we don't know what's going on for Charlie's dad. He may have incredible pressure going on that we're not aware of. And so working alongside him and opening up a conversation about what's working in his family, what is he worried about, you know, does he have fears for Charlie? You know, what does he wish for? How did he go when he was growing up? Did he have models of parenting? Can he empathise with the experiences that Charlie's going through? Some of the most amazing experiences I've had in session have been when dads have chosen to be vulnerable in front of their sons. And what I mean by that is sharing that, say, they suffered terribly from anxiety when they were little, or that they really understand how it feels to lose a pet. And it's amazingly powerful for a young boy to hear their dad. I remember I had a boy one time describe his dad literally as 10 foot tall. And for his dad to then come into session and say he was bullied at school when he was little, as his son was, made a profound difference in terms of his son opening up and being able to connect back in with his dad. So I think looking for the strengths holding in mind that everybody is able to change and willing to change if we can connect with them in the right way.
Thanks, Nicola. Sarah, a question for you from Sarah. What happens if the parents won't meet together, or they might, a little bit as Nicola's alluded to, if they're conflictual? So can you tell us a little bit about your experience in working with families who might be conflictual or even difficult to engage?
Yeah, sure. Thanks, Dan. You know, I think as Nicola indicated at the beginning of her presentation, it's really important for us to share with a family how valuable it is to have everyone around the table and to do some problem solving around what some of those barriers might be to different members coming, you know, whether it's time of the appointment, location, those sorts of things, to show our willingness to be flexible in our service delivery so that we can demonstrate the value that we place on having everyone there. But I guess in my experience, certainly, it was often that I was only working with one parent, and that does present certain challenges where you don't get the full picture and then you're not able to convey all the information that you hope to the other parent. And in those situations, I think some of the things that have worked for me is to be really clear about the key messages that you're working on with the parent and the child in the session. And then to continually seek opportunities to draw in the other parent, which in my experience typically I'd be working with the mother and the child and looking for opportunities to bring the father in. And so it might be that at the end of the session, you know, you really clarify what are the key messages that you've all worked on today that can be shared at home. And sometimes it's even about providing those in a written form to help convey those messages, but also continually opening that door for the other family members to come along. And I think you've alluded to the father in this situation, but sometimes, you know, families are, you know, they look all shapes and sizes these days. And so sometimes it's about grandparents, aunties, other adults that live in the house. And the more people, when you're working with a child, who understand what it is that you're trying to achieve, and also the better understanding you have of the context that child's functioning in, you know, the more successful you're going to be. So I think, you know, sometimes it's a challenge that's difficult to overcome, in which case you continue to open that door and try and problem solve ways to bring them in. But in the meantime, it's really important to try and open that flow of information as best you can so that you're sharing the information as openly as you can.
Thanks for that, Sarah. And another question for you from Lucy, who's really asked a question about when psychological problems are evident in the parent of a child referred to you for therapy. How can you protect against this issue dominating family therapy? And in particular, how do you cater for parents who are experiencing mental illness during therapy sessions?
Sure, thanks, Dan. I think it's a really difficult one because relationships are really important, and you do need to give attention to building a relationship with the parent and the child if you're going to be effective in the way that you're working. But when you have a parent with any sort of chronic health condition, you need to factor in their capacity in what you're asking that family to do and what you're hoping to achieve. And so certainly I think if you've got a parent who is experiencing mental illness, and it's likely to be an ongoing chronic situation, and so opening up some conversations around, what does that mean for the family? What does that mean for the child and the child's experience with the parent when the parent's perhaps well and unwell, and then planning, for those times when the child is having to cope with their parents not being as well and when their parent is well. And I think the other really probably key thing here is to work in a family-centred way. So children are so reliant on what the capacity of their parent is, and so when we're working with children, it is also our role to support that family and to make sure that certainly if the parent has mental illness or any other chronic condition, that they are also getting the support that they need so that they're in I guess, the best capacity available to their child. And so that might mean looking at making sure that the parent's receiving support outside your session, if it's not appropriate that it occurs in the session, or if you are able to provide the parent support within the session in a family-centred way, that may be suitable in some ways. I think probably the other thing I just want to mention, when the capacity of a parent is compromised in some way at sometimes, I think, and Mandy alluded to this in her presentation, it's really important for us to look at how we can wrap supports around that whole family. So, what might be the role of the school in supporting that family, the parent and the child? What friends or relatives might be available to wrap around that parent and that child? And if we work in that family-centred way, I think our outcomes are likely to be better in those situations.
Yeah, great answer, thank you. Mandy, lots of questions coming in around how a professional might help and support a parent that might be struggling in their role as a parent.
So giving them tools to and resources of where they can go to for support. So first of all, I guess telling them that they're doing okay, there's no such thing as the perfect parent, because I sometimes think we set out as new parents to be perfect, and maybe we need someone to say, hey, that doesn't actually exist. Giving them places to go to maybe get some education around parenting. So I did some of the Triple P courses and found things like that valuable. And I guess what I appreciated most from with parenting, well, when, people would act as a parenting support, was just being there and listening to what you have to say. So, you feel like if you've told someone and they haven't jumped off their seat or yelled at you, so you must be doing okay. Having an ear to just say, I hear you. Again, you're not alone. Other parents feel like this because you're in this isolated little role where maybe you don't see many parents or get to work to see what other people
do.
So
I guess just listening is the number one thing I could say initially for that.
Thanks, Mandy. The next question's for you, Nicola, and it comes from Catherine, which is a really great question because I think it happens often really really often within a counselling setting. So Catherine's just wondering how you might go about engaging parents who do not always put in place the strategies you suggested. And reasons for this might include they don't have time, they don't see a point, or they might not think it'll be useful.
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I think that Mandy made a really good point. I think in working with parents, and if you're asking them to try new strategies or get more involved in play, like Sarah talked about, and then when you catch up with them in the following session, you know, how did you go with that? Did any of that happen? And they say no. Just to not tell them off, not come down on them hard, but problem solve with them about what got in the way. So, you know, was it a time issue? Was it a lack of confidence? Did they feel silly? And just working with them about, you know, how can we make it happen? Is it, there something about that that you felt uncomfortable with? Or, as you say, do you not see the point? And if they don't see the point, then you haven't done your job well enough in explaining the point of that, I think. And parents can just nod and agree. If we just tell them what to do all the time, they can, yes, 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 and we haven't given them enough space for questions, or they don't actually understand what we're asking them to do, or we're using jargon, you know, connect with your child at the bottom of the circle and fill their cup and blah, blah, blah. We all get used to talking to each other in our services and we know what that means. But versus being very practical, like Sarah spoke about, you know, can you carve out 5 minutes at time at bedtime to sit with your child and have a chat to them and ask them about their day? And if that didn't happen, why not? Well, because the baby's screaming at that time and my mum calls at that time at night. And so you need to be practical and give parents a chance to tell you why things did or didn't work, or what they felt about them, and then work together, I think, to try and move your way through those rather than them feeling like naughty school children that haven't done their homework.
Thanks, Nicola. The next question is for you also, from Nicola. And really this question's around the structure of therapy sessions. So Nicola's really asking, at what stage do you invite a child to be present with their parents during therapy? Do you have a particular practice around this?
I suppose my particular practice is it depends. It really depends on the age of the child. And your monitoring of how that will go. I do quite a lot of trauma therapy, for example, and it's vital that, for example, in that situation, not exactly the same as here, but if I had been dealing with Charlie and he talked about that he could hear his parents fighting at night and he was really worried about that and we'd maybe talked about it and how he felt about that, ultimately he'd want to bring his parents in to share that information. But you really need to be sure that Charlie's going to get a safe response. And so you wouldn't want to bring mum and dad in to hear that conversation if you didn't feel that they were able yet to hear that in a way that you thought was going to be supporting Charlie's needs. And that might be that because he'll maybe scared that mum will get really upset. Kids hate making their parents cry. And so I've had lots of clients over the years that say, I can't tell mum that she'll cry. And so we often have this conversation about what that means. And so in a part of the session or a separate session with mum, you might give her some of the information. You might even role play it and also have a directly address those concerns. So I've had parents, you know, tell their children directly that I might cry, but it doesn't mean I'm broken. I can hear it and still be your mum and look after you. It's not a sign of weakness. So we're starting to address some of those issues that you can show vulnerable emotions and still be okay, because parents we're not often that explicit with our kids, and kids worry that, you know, I can't make mum cry. That's a terrible thing. Whereas, you know, I cry all the time. It doesn't mean I'm broken. It means I hear it and I feel it and I can still be your parent. And the same with a response that might be angry. So how are we going to make sure that dad can hear those questions and respond with an empathic response and not be frightening to Charlie? So it's your job to judge that and support everybody in the family so those conversations can be constructive, and also that you're kind of mirroring at the same time that expressing feelings is healthy, and that's how we move forward, and we're helping everybody in the family develop those skills as we move through this path together.
Yeah, thanks for that, Nicola. Just on that theme, Nina has asked, when you do have parents in the room with you, and they might be speaking pejoratively or negatively about their child when the child is in the room, what kind of strategies do you have for that?
I think so. That happens, of course. It happens. That why you start with sessions without the kids in the room to start off with, so we can have these free and frank conversations and set up that expectation. But that's no guarantee that it's not going to happen in future sessions. And I really think it's your job in the room to address it there and then, to say, you know, we want to keep the conversation constructive. You know, when we talk about Charlie in that way, I think that, it looks to me like Charlie might be a bit upset about what you've said, and can we try and keep it constructive? Or, you know, but those sorts of things, I think you have to address it. You're an adult and you're not trying to shame the parent or escalate the situation, but work with them again. You're modelling how to have constructive conversations and to talk about that or even reframe it. Like, you know, Dad, you're saying that Charlie seems like a sissy. You know, what does that mean to you? Does that mean you worry about him, his feelings? Are you worried about him getting picked on at school? So you're getting to the what's behind that defence or that aggressive response to try and keep moving the conversation forward. But you can't let it slide because you've got a responsibility for the child in the room as well.
Yeah, thanks, Nicola. Mandy, there's lots of questions coming through again around working with a family where a parent might have a mental illness. What can a health professional say and do, for that matter, where a parent in the room is experiencing a mental illness?
Very close to my heart. What can they do? They can assure you that no one is going to take your children from you. So no matter what you say or how honest you are, their aim is not to... I know that there is a strong feeling, and I've discussed it with other parents who have experienced mental illness, there is that fear that if I disclose too much, they'll take them away. They'll think that I'm a really bad parent. So just making them feel comfortable that it's okay, making the space safe, and I guess that happens over a period of time. So this poor mum will be able to tell all, and she may have been wanting to tell this for a long time. Making it feel that it's okay, knowing that other people have it. So just trying to normalise the situation, because it feels very abnormal to be told you have a mental illness, especially when you haven't had any experience prior to that. So all of a sudden you enter a new world full of new words, scary words. So just tiptoeing into it, but hopefully building up a relationship together where there can be complete honesty. I think that's really important.
Thanks, Mandy.
Thanks.
That's really useful information and a great answer. Thank you. Next question for Sarah, from Sarah. Can you give some play ideas for a 9-year-old boy? As you mentioned in your presentation, it can become less obvious as the child gets older.
Yeah, I think the important thing is that the play ideas come from the child. So, you know, some 9-year-olds are all going to be about daredevils, fast and furious, and other 9-year-olds might be about, you know, drawing and Lego and quieter activities. So I think, you know, one of the really important elements of working with families to find connection time for children and their parents is to help the parents see that the child needs to be the leader in that moment. So, you know, they need to be looking and learning about what their child is interested in and supporting their interests. And that's how you're really going to get that strengthening relationship. So, you know, I'm not sure that there's any magic list of great things to offer for a 9-year-old, but I think, you know, if you can help a family see that they need to learn about what their 9-year-old's interested in, then that's probably the best way to go.
Yeah, and just on that, Sarah, some questions. How do you, in initial sessions, motivate parents to work with you around play, particularly if they're feeling resistant or this might not be something that's particularly natural to them? What sort of strategies do you have around that?
Yeah, thanks, Dan. I think it's not uncommon, actually, for parents to be almost disappointed when they see you're asking them to do a big portion of the work rather than you in the therapy session going to solve all the problems for them. And so I think, you know, I tailor my motivational strategies for parents depending a bit on the parent. But one of the things I think, especially with play, because it can seem a little bit everyday and a little bit too simplistic, I think one of the things I have found really effective is actually to share research and to share evidence and to do that in ways that's really accessible for families who we're working with. But if we can, you know, clearly say and provide, you know, really clear information to families about, you know, play as the primary medium for growing cognitive thinking skills and problem solving skills and playing with others as a key strategy for developing social skills, you know, whatever it is that that parent is wanting their child to have, you know, there is a role for playing developing those skills. So I think sometimes it's about being really strategic about how we convey what I guess is the rigour in play of what we're hoping to achieve. And then I think the other thing is if we're asking, certainly in my work, you know, you do some role modelling, you do some, you have to be playful yourself and be prepared to be the silly person so that they can begin to feel more comfortable to be playful with their child and let their guard down as well.
Yeah, thanks, Sarah. And sorry to bombard you, but there's a host of questions here regarding play. So can you talk to us a little bit about how you've utilised methods of play in working with a broad range of families, and in particular families, I suppose, from diverse cultural backgrounds?
Sure, yeah. I think that relates actually a little bit to the previous question in my experience. It depends a little bit on the cultural background of families, but certainly in more recent times I've been working with some families who are quite perhaps academic, looking, you know, for strong academic outcomes, or they want to have a very authoritarian approach with their child, a very teacher, you know, and testing, teach the skill and then test the skill kind of approach, or to, you know, to do lots of sort of very clear guiding with their child. And again, I think, you know, what I've had to do there is to provide some really clear information to families about how, you know, play is the primary medium through which children learn. And it's actually, if we, you know, look to work with children in the way that they most deeply engage, which is play, they're often way more comfortable in a play session than they are in a talking session, then, you know, that provides another avenue for us to try and progress towards what perhaps the parent might see as the priorities. And I think, you know, it's a little bit about getting some small wins, so also working with families to set some small achievable goals where they might actually see some benefits and some changes. You know, kids like Charlie, parents have sadly probably started to mostly notice Charlie when his behaviour is challenging, because, you know, Chris and Kate have got their own problems. But if we can encourage parents to look to notice their children you know, in times when they're not causing problems and when they're happily engaging, then we can actually shift a parent's view and perspective of their child, and they may actually start to see, oh, actually my child has more capabilities and more strengths than I'd realised, and we can grow that story.
Great. Thanks, Sarah. The next question is from Kerry, and for you, Mandy. It's really about, and you touched on this a little bit before, where a parent may be feeling anxious that what they tell a practitioner or a professional will result in a child protection notification. How do you engage with a parent where a reassurance that you perhaps won't inform child protection is simply not possible?
I guess by telling them situations where it might be reported, so educating them a little bit about why child protection might come into a situation, telling them and assuring them that this isn't one of those, that they're there to help you, that they're there to keep the family together, that they're there for the support of the children as well, and for the best for the they want the best for the children. So just reassuring them that the family unit will stay together, and just trying to knock it out, that thought of that something bad will happen if you disclose stuff. So again, I said, as I was saying, that relationship needs to grow. I found that there were certain people that I started to trust over a period of time. What made me trust them? Sometimes I think about that. Maybe it was someone I seemed to click more with, or just that reassurance that these are the sorts of things that might go to a child protection or into a child protection issue, but this is your health. Just like you come to tell me you might have diabetes or a broken leg, I'm here to help you. I want to see you well, and I want to help you get well. So I hope that answers the question.
Yeah, it does. Thank you very much, Brandy.
The
next question is for Nicola. Nicola, a couple of questions around schools' roles in all of this, given we're talking about school-aged children. What can mm-hmm. schools do to make these conversations with children possible?
Schools need to know what's going on in order to help, I think, and schools carry an enormous burden in terms of looking after children, but they also have a great opportunity to help families. But they need to know what's going on, as Mandy has shared, that schools are there to support families and children, and they are best able to do that if they're aware of what's going on. In this situation, it may just be letting the teacher know that his dog died. That's what's going on at home. He's been a little bit sad, so his teacher or the educators within the school are aware that Charlie might be having a bit of a rough time, or if mum feels more comfortable sharing that there's some issues in the family and that she's noticed that Charlie's sleep has been disrupted. They don't have to give all the information to the schools, but the schools can only do what they can when they know what's going on. And I think as a psychologist working, if you're working with a family, then it's really important to, with permission, of course, to share. If you've got strategies that you're working with Charlie on, for example, around expressing his feelings or managing his emotions, then you want to share that information, whether it be through information or updates through his teacher, so she can help support the same strategies. You know, poor Charlie doesn't want to get the two strategies from me about how to support his anger, and then his teacher's teaching him other ones. So, or the teacher says, do this breathing exercise, and Nicola said to do it the other way. So I think particularly as psychologists, sometimes we can be a bit siloed, and we don't necessarily share the strategies that we're working with families openly enough, or encouraging, or even just telling families to do the same thing. So ensuring that the supports that wrap around the family are all on the same page. So supporting schools rather than just condemning them if they don't know what's going on, or if they're not aware of what you're working on with them. So keeping the communication open. And again, Mandy mentioned the role of the school counsellor. School counsellors are overwhelmed often, and so they're not always able to offer say ongoing therapy, but they can offer a safe space for Charlie to go to. They can offer information about further supports and services. And so again, linking in and just trying to keep the communication between the different parties open, so Charlie and his parents feel like they've got the support, and principals are there to do that. And in my experience, that when you work with a school and openly communicate, they're relieved and they're surprised sometimes that we actually do it, because that's what they're wanting. They can't operate if they don't, with silence. If they don't know what's going on, we can't then criticise them for how they respond or don't respond.
Right. Thank you, Nicola. The last question probably we have time for tonight comes from Watton, who asks, Sarah, can you please suggest some evidence-based resources that highlight the importance of play? And Sarah, I can probably jump in and answer that, because our panellists tonight provided some supporting resources. So for audience members who want to go to the supporting resources tab at the bottom of the screen, please do so, and you'll be able to find some supporting resources for tonight, and plus they'll be on the Emerging Minds and MHPN website subsequent to tonight's webinar. So what I'm going to do now is ask our three panellists just to briefly sum up the main thoughts or the final thoughts that they have for tonight. So Nicola, I might start with you if I may.
Sure. I think just in summary, if you're working with Charlie and his family, you're doing exactly that and communicating that we're working with the whole family, that you're there to help them to get back on the road that they are hoping for. And I think hope is really important to say that, you know, this is, we're here, we're going to work on this. These sorts of things are really best addressed early on, and that's great that they're there. So setting that expectation that you'll work collaboratively, that everyone will have a say and they'll be listened to and taken seriously, and that your job is to help them find their way back together. And so hope plus practical strategies and support.
Thank you for that, Nicola. And thank you for tonight. Sarah, some closing thoughts for you?
Yes, I think probably the closing thought for me is really that, you know, families like Charlie's are really going through difficult times. And if, as part of the work that we're doing with them, we can help them find a way to share some happy times, even if they are small and short, then I think, you know, that can provide them a sense of what can come and what hopefully there'll be more of in the future. So I think, you know, to bear in mind that it can be a nice balancing strategy to include in your work overall with families like Charlie, to look for opportunities to plan for and scaffold around some shared joy between parents and children.
Yeah, that's a really powerful message you've left us with tonight, so thank you for that, Sarah. Mandy, some final thoughts from you?
Yeah, so Dan, something that I'm just sitting here thinking, I wish I said that last time, so I'll say it now. Just prompting people to, or your client or your patient, to reveal sort of truth. So I was very closed and I thought I will never ever tell anyone that I heard voices, because I'm sure if I disclose that to anyone, they will take my children from me and they'll think that I'm a freak and I, you know, who knows what might happen. So I remember as I started to come and talk more about the psychotic experience that I experienced, I remember a GP saying to me in one consultation, "Did you hear voices?" And I remember at the time thinking, okay, and I'll be honest, because you know, you'd be honest with the doctor. And I said yes to that. I would never have given up that information voluntarily unless she had brought it up or prompted me to answer or reveal that. So yeah, prompt. Have you been sad? Do you have panic attacks? So giving prompts, it's then easy to say yes than to bring it up yourself. It gives you permission to talk about those sorts of things where it doesn't feel like if someone doesn't raise it, you're less likely to speak about it. So, yeah, we could prompt, please. Thank you.
Thanks, Mandy. Really appreciate those final thoughts for our presentations from all three of our panellists tonight. So I really want to thank them. And I think you'll agree that both the presentations and the Q&A session were really rich in some potential strategies in working with children and their families. So thank you to all three of Nicola, Sarah and Mandy. Okay, so we're right at the tail end of tonight's presentation. So thank you again to everyone that's been with us throughout tonight. Really enjoyed giving this to you. Resources and further reading are available, so please take advantage of that. And for further information, really encourage you to visit our website at www.emergingminds.com.au. Before you leave tonight too, just a reminder, we'd really appreciate your feedback. So if you could do that before you left, that would be fantastic. So thank you for participating tonight. Certificates of attendance for this webinar will be issued generally within about 4 weeks, and each participant will be sent a link to the online resources associated with this webinar within 2 weeks. And as we mentioned before, we've got a really exciting webinar planned for you on the 7th of November, which is really around engaging with parents with children approaching adolescence, which I'm sure will strike a chord for many of you both personally and professionally. And we have Dr. Michael Carr-Gregg and Ellie Robinson who'll be sharing the findings of some of their practice as well as some of the very detailed research. So we look forward to that. Just to let you know that this webinar was co-produced by MHPN and Emerging Minds for the Emerging Minds National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health. The National Workforce Centre for Child Mental Health is led by Emerging Minds and delivered in partnership with the Australian Institute of Family Studies, the Australian National University, the Parenting Research Centre and the Royal Australian College of General Practitioners. The Workforce Centre is funded by the Australian Government Department of Health under the National Support for Child and Youth Mental Health Program. Thank you for tonight. Before I close, I'd just like to acknowledge the consumers and carers who have lived with mental illness in the past and those who continue to live with mental illness in the present. And thank you for everyone for participating in tonight's webinar.